child in facilities filled with people that the United States functionally treated as non-people. And it took a very valiant effort by local attorneys and by the American Civil Liberties Union to challenge his detention. Ultimately, instead of outright losing the case, as a judge indicated after she ruled Adam had to go free because the FBI admitted that it relied on a jail. Adam was ultimately successful once the government dropped its case in order to preserve its power to do this. And he lives in freedom, I'm happy to say, right now in Rwanda.
We have 30 seconds. What has surprised you most about what is happening today?
Very little at this point, I'm sorry to say, surprises me. But the general indifference by the American political and intellectual elites to the relationship between the war on terror and the erosion of democracy is also a very deep thread and very historically rooted, not just in the war on terror, but before. And certainly seeing that those connections have to be made in order to have any form of real democracy in this country and safety and dignity for so many people.
Spencer Ackerman, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Pulitzer Prize-winning national security reporter, his new book, Reign of Terror: How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much.
This is Judy Berry from Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got four requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon hospitals are pushed to their limit in the Delta surge. Healthcare workers and school staff must get vaccinated. And official plans to handle far-right violence this weekend are left unclear. Evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 20th, 2021. I'm Sam Bowman. The Delta variant of the coronavirus has overwhelmed state hospitals, and now officials are requesting help from out of state. State officials have asked for 35 doctors, 35 advanced practice providers, 300 registered nurses, 10 paramedics, and 100 respiratory therapists. FEMA will send 24 EMTs to Central and Southern Oregon within the next 4 days. The Oregon Health Authority has also requested a mobile hospital from FEMA. Governor Brown said this in a press conference Thursday.
some hospital regions are beginning the day with two ICU beds available or none at all. Overwhelmingly, the Oregonians who are being hospitalized or who are dying from COVID-19 are unvaccinated. This isn't just about beds. It's about having enough trained healthcare professionals to treat patients. Our nurses, doctors, and healthcare workers have been on the front lines of this pandemic in full PPE for over 17 months, providing life-saving treatment for the patients in their care. We are all at risk right now when our hospitals are full. There may not be a staff bed for you if you have an unexpected medical emergency. When ambulances have nowhere to go, people die preventable deaths. I am devoting all available resources to help, including deploying the National Guard and nurse strike teams, establishing temporary decompression units to free up hospital bed space, and removing barriers to discharging patients who no longer require hospital-level care.
That was Oregon Governor Kate Brown. Health workers are not the only employees who will be required to be fully vaccinated in order to stay at their jobs. Staff at K-12 schools must be vaccinated by the fall, according to a new rule from the governor. Teachers, administrators, support staff, and volunteers will need to be vaccinated by October 18th, or 6 weeks after full FDA approval. Brown stressed that this measure is important because none of the vaccines are approved yet for children under 12 years old. In Washington state, the vaccine mandate goes even further, including colleges, universities, and child care centers, a move that Oregon has yet to make. Multnomah County employees will also be required to get the coronavirus vaccine. Officials say these measures are important because the hospitalization rate has increased 500% in the past month. Oregon Health Authority Director Patrick Allen called it a pandemic of the unvaccinated, unquote.
I want to be honest. The situation in Oregon's hospitals is growing increasingly dire. Our healthcare system is on the verge of collapse in parts of the state. In coming weeks, every Oregon hospital could be overtopped. Right now, ambulances are transporting more people in respiratory distress, but they have to wait longer to get patients into emergency departments because those beds are full. Patients are spending days in emergency departments because critical care beds aren't available. Right now, more than 200 patients are boarding in Oregon hospital EDs waiting for a bed. Hospitals are converting outpatient rooms to medical surgical rooms or ICU beds. Patients are parked in hallways. Staffing is critically short. I need to be direct about what's causing this crisis. A growing wave of unvaccinated patients who have become so seriously sick with the Delta variant they need to be hospitalized. We've said it before, the COVID-19 pandemic is now a pandemic of the unvaccinated. More than a quarter of the adult population still remains unprotected from COVID-19. Overwhelmed hospitals are what happens when such a large reservoir of vulnerable people offers itself as a target for a virus that has killed more than 600,000 Americans and almost 3,000 Oregonians. State health officials are working desperately alongside hospital administrators and staff to keep Oregon hospitals staffed and beds open. But here's what we all need to face. Oregon hospitals are not far from reaching the point where health systems may not be able to provide the highest level of care to everyone who needs it. Whether they have COVID-19, or if they've been in an accident, or if they've had a heart attack, or any other of many medical crises any of us could suddenly and unexpectedly experience today or any day in our lives. We're not at that grim point yet. But if we don't act, the crushing influx of unvaccinated COVID-19 patients means that doctors and nurses in some hospitals may soon face the terrible prospect of having to make heart-wrenching triage decisions about whom they can save and whom they cannot.
That was Oregon Health Authority Director Patrick Allen. On Wednesday, a Roseburg hospital reported that a COVID patient died inside the hospital waiting for an ICU bed to open up. Total coronavirus cases in Oregon through the entire pandemic reached 250,000 today. 500 National Guard troops will be deployed to 20 hospitals around the state to support frontline healthcare workers. More National Guard troops are expected to be called up soon. Pediatricians and family physicians are urging school administrators, parents, and community members to mask up in schools and for adults to get COVID vaccinations if they can. This as more children are being admitted to hospitals across the country due to complications from coronavirus. Lily Bolke has the story in Indiana.
Hospitals in Indiana are seeing an increase in children being admitted with complications due to the coronavirus, which they say is a combination of the Delta variant and kids going back to school. Doctors are voicing concerns that at school board and school start meetings, some parents continue to oppose mask mandates. Dr. Emily Scott, who heads the American Academy of Pediatrics Indiana chapter, emphasizes that masks and the COVID-19 vaccines have been proven safe and effective. She believes both are needed to protect Hoosier kids.
Just like kids know that they have to put on a seatbelt to get in the car and drive safely, or they know they have to put on their helmet to ride their bike, kids are doing quite well with masking in schools, and they are very safe for kids to wear all day long in school.
Scott adds for kids under 12 who are not yet approved to receive the vaccine, masking, social distancing, and testing are key. But she says it's also important the adults in their lives are vaccinated if they are able to receive it. Governor Eric Holcomb has expressed his support for schools that choose to require masks. Scott points to a study from Georgia that found schools with universal masking have 37% fewer positive COVID-19 cases.
Some kids are requiring to be in the hospital. There's kids in the ICU with COVID, and so we really want to take this seriously. Masking in schools is just a really simple and easy step that we can do that will be effective.
Dr. Samir Ginde, president of the Indiana Academy of Family Physicians, also urges people to be diligent about where they get their COVID information and recommends the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He notes a lot of misinformation has spread about the safety of masks as well as the vaccines.
They're difficult to decipher what's real, what's myth, what's fact. And I would ask that, you know, everybody try to use legitimate websites to get the information.
I'm Lily Bolke reporting.
This Sunday, the 22nd of August, marks the one-year anniversary of armed pro-Trump demonstrators brawling with anti-fascist counter-protesters in downtown Portland. One year later, the Proud Boys are planning to return. An anonymous flyer circulated online reading, quote, "United We Win, Event for Patriots, Don't Tread on Me," end quote. Soon, an opposition flyer followed reading, calling all anti-fascists, "Fight back, all out." Last year, far-right extremists fought with anti-fascists for hours in front of the Multnomah County Justice Center. Plans for how to avoid such violence instigated by outside groups coming into the city this year haven't been clarified by authorities. City, county, and state officials have issued statements condemning violence and supporting peaceful expressions of free speech. Portland Police Chief Chuck Lavelle said in a statement, quote, "Our message is, those planning to come down to engage in violence, don't come. You should not expect to see police officers standing in the middle of the crowd trying to keep people apart and avoid physical confrontation," end quote. The statement from Chief Lavelle also says that police, quote, "may make arrests for crimes like violent activity or property destruction," quote, "where resources allow." Last year, the Portland police said their lack of intervention in the brawl was because many officers were running on low sleep from policing the demonstration the night before. The Portland police's response to different protest groups has been disparate. Far-right extremists are not often treated with the same severity as left-leaning protesters. At the beginning of August 2021, Proud Boys gathered in downtown Portland and acted as security for a rally held by an anti-LGBTQ and anti-COVID restriction preacher. They again brawled with counter-protesters with police nearby. That night, one far-right extremist pointed a gun at a Willamette Week journalist. The gun was later determined to be an airsoft gun, and the man was charged with a count of menacing. A former Portland club owner has settled a lawsuit with Black Portlanders who accused him of discriminating against them and other Black patrons through arbitrary dress codes. Chris Lenahan owns several clubs in Portland's Old Town, like Dirty Nightlife, Splash Bar, Shake Bar, The Barrel Room, and the Paris Theater. The lawsuit was brought by Portlander Ray Peterson and another group of Black patrons who were denied entry to Splash Bar on the same night in August 2018 for dress code violations. Peterson wore, quote, too many chains, according to the security guard, and the other group was denied for one person wearing shorts and another wearing a fedora. In both cases, the groups were offered entry if they paid an extra sum of money. The lawsuit accused Lenihan of using security guards to enforce discriminatory rules to keep black patrons out of his club, and has been settled out of court for an unspecified sum. State law prohibits discriminating against a protected class in a, quote, place of public accommodation, which would include Lenihan's clubs. Lenihan has since sold his Portland clubs and has moved on to nightlife in Tampa, Florida, where one of his clubs lost its liquor license for hosting unmasked patrons last year. Peterson told the Portland Mercury about his drive to file the lawsuit. Quote, I stepped up because I want it to be known that this is not a normal way to be treated. It sucks that I have to prepare my son to be treated this way. It shouldn't be like that. He deserves better. We all deserve better. We get treated so poorly in this city. End quote. The Corvallis to Sea Trail finally opens this weekend after nearly 50 years of development. The trail is 60 miles long and traverses the area its name suggests, from Corvallis to the Pacific Ocean. It offers hikers an uninterrupted through route, and it officially opens to the public on Saturday. Most of the trail is through abandoned roads on public lands that are tied to timber management, though there are a few miles on the shoulders of streets and highways. Planners of the Corvallis to Sea Trail say the route can be done in 3 days if you're ambitious, but more leisurely hikers might take 5 or 6. Most hikers will go east to west, with their reward being the Pacific Ocean, but there are other notable landmarks along the way, like a side trail to reach Mary's Peak in the Central Coast Range. The idea for the trail came from an OSU graduate in 1974 and would face obstacles and obscurity until the early 90s. The plans for the trail were revived in 2003, and the eastern and western portions of the trail were completed in 2016 and 2018, respectively. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for episode 2 of It Did Happen Here. It's the story of the unlikely collaboration between groups of immigrants, civil rights activists, militant youth, and queer organizers who came together to successfully confront neo-Nazi violence. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sonali. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly cloudy with an overnight low of 60 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds will continue with a high of 75. An air quality advisory is in effect due to smoke for counties east of the Cascades and Jackson County. Today in history, in 1910, the Great Fire of 1910, also referred to as the Devil's Broom Fire, consumed 3 million acres in northern Idaho and western Montana. Strong winds caused numerous small fires to combine into a firestorm of unprecedented size. The quote of the day is from author Louise Dickinson Rich in their book, We Took to the Woods. Quote, a house you can rebuild, a bridge you can restring, a washed out road you can fill in, but there is nothing you can do about a tree but mourn. A suspect who claimed to have a bomb was arrested at the U.S. Capitol. With that story and more, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
We don't know if there are any explosives in the vehicle. It's still an active scene. While Mr. Rosenberry has been taken into custody and has been removed from the scene, we still have to search the vehicle and render the vehicle safe.
Capitol Police Chief Thomas Manger says a suspect identified as Floyd Ray Rosenberry surrendered to authorities and was taken into custody hours after he parked a pickup truck near the Capitol and claimed to have a bomb, spurring evacuations of several nearby buildings. Billions of dollars of U.S. weapons are now in the hands of the Taliban, following the collapse of Afghan security forces trained to use the military equipment. President Biden said his August 31st deadline for U.S. withdrawal from the country will be delayed if all Americans are not out by then. Army Major General Hank Taylor said Thursday flights out of the country are being expedited.
This increase is reflective of both a ramp up of aircraft and airlift capability, faster processing of evacuees, and greater information and fidelity in reporting.
Three senators announced within hours of each other Thursday they tested positive for the coronavirus, despite being fully vaccinated. Mississippi Republican Senator Roger Wicker, Independent Angus King of Maine, and Democratic Senator John Hickenlooper of Colorado each confirmed they had breakthrough cases. A federal judge has thrown out Trump administration approvals for a large planned oil project on Alaska's North Slope. U.S. District Court Judge Sharon Gleason in Anchorage vacated crude oil producer ConocoPhillips' permits, saying the federal review was flawed and didn't include measures for wildlife. Governor of Alaska Mike Dunleavy criticized the decision.
What some of these policy decisions actually end up doing is causing distortions in the market because of politics and ensuring that homegrown oil production and gas production here in the United States doesn't grow.
The Federal Trade Commission has filed a new complaint accusing Facebook of illegally maintaining a monopoly by squelching competitors. Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal in an exchange with CEO Mark Zuckerberg on the company's alleged practices.
Facebook cloned a popular product, approached the company you identified as a competitive threat, and told them that if they didn't let you buy them up, there would be consequences. Were there any other companies that you used the same tactic with while attempting to buy them?
The Department of Education says it's discharging the outstanding student loans of more than 323,000 borrowers who have significant permanent disabilities and will remove barriers for borrowers who qualify for relief in the future. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
This summer, families across the country have been receiving a little extra money each month with the expanded child tax credit kicking in. A new national poll shows that 78% of families who get the monthly child tax credit payments spent the funds right away on their housing, food, and utilities. Mike Moen has more on efforts to extend the tax credit in Minnesota.
Today is payday for many Americans. Families trying to make ends meet are also getting a bump each month thanks to the expanded federal child tax credit. Some Minnesota parents say they hope it doesn't expire. Under the American Rescue Plan, the Biden administration boosted the annual credit to $3,000 per child. The changes allow qualifying parents to receive a portion of the credit through monthly payments that started in mid-July. Sarah Agutter, a mother of two from St. Paul, says the pandemic drastically cut into her household income. She says the extra checks provide breathing room that allows her to stay focused on her kids.
Before these child checks, I had to work two jobs, so running my own business and then another job, and I barely ever got to see my kids.
However, the expanded credit is only temporary, with monthly payments scheduled to finish at year's end. Supporters say Congress needs to make the expansion permanent, allowing families to stay afloat and prosper. But opponents, including GOP lawmakers, say it could deter people from working while leading to fraud. A poll from the group Parents Together Action says 90% of respondents reported the funds made a difference in their lives. Jenna Fulford, a fellow parent from St. Paul who works two jobs, says the monthly payments have allowed her to afford her rising rent payment. She says if the credit expires or if she fails to secure pay raises, she could be uprooted from a place that she's called home for several years.
The rent has been affordable, but if it keeps climbing, I don't know how much longer what I'll be able to afford.
The Children's Defense Fund also is calling for a permanent expansion. It says July payments were used by 375,000 Minnesotans to buy food, 86,000 for school supplies, and 164,000 families for housing. The group says those expenses will still be around after the current payments expire in December. Mike Moen, Minnesota News Connection.
The Pasquayaki tribe has scored a reservation voting rights victory to reinstate a local voting site. With that story and more, it's Trip Krause with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Trip Krause, in for Antonia Gonzalez.
For the last 3 years, the Pascua-Yaqui tribe in southern Arizona has been advocating for the county official in charge of early voting to reinstate an early voting site in its urban reservation, going so far as to file a lawsuit against the Pima County, Arizona Recorder's Office last year. Emmett Gibson with Arizona Public Media reports that the tribe and the recorder's office are celebrating a settlement in the case.
The settlement lays out that for every statewide primary and general election from now till the end of 2024, the Pascua-Yaqui tribe will have an early voting site within its reservation. Chairman Peter Yocopicio says with this new site, even if the monsoon rains flood the streets into Tucson during early voting, people will still be able to vote within the reservation.
This has touched a place in my heart, and for our people, you know, I almost cried when they told us, hey, you are going to get restored your voting site.
He says the right to vote is just as important in Arizona Indian Country as it is in an Arizona county. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
The California Senate unanimously voted to approve a measure that would create a state holiday on California Native American Day for court employees. The state holiday would exchange for Columbus Day and be observed on the fourth Friday of September. California State Assembly member James Ramos introduced the measure.
We've been working on this holiday for well over 20-something years. Ultimately, got elected to the State Assembly and was approached to move forward a bill that would exchange for the court systems in the state of California Columbus Day as a paid holiday and exchange it for California Native American Day as the paid holiday for the court systems in the state of California.
The measure awaits the governor's signature.
And because California Native American Day has been celebrated within the Indian community for years, we know that there'll be ongoing activities. So we encourage the population in the state of California on California Native American Day to get out and learn more about California's first people that makes this state what it is today.
While marijuana remains illegal in North Carolina, the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians voted to establish a medical marijuana program on tribal lands. Eastern Band Principal Chief Richard Steed spoke to the ordinance during a tribal council meeting on August 5th.
And the issue is, this is a compassionate care issue. This is an issue for people who have chronic pain, for people who have cancer and who are on chemotherapy and cannot eat, for people who have PTSD, for soldiers who have come back from combat, for those who are battling opioid addiction, this is the off-ramp.
The ordinance creates a legal framework for a medical cannabis program, an advisory commission to study cannabis-related issues, as well as a control board to set regulations.
We are a sovereign. We are a nation, and our people have asked for this. I can assure you there has been extreme diligence done in crafting this ordinance. A tremendous amount of diligence done in researching operations, the manufacturing side, the dispensary side, etc. We have the capacity to do it. We have the wherewithal to do it. And it is my sincere hope that you all today have the will to do it. Thank you.
The Oneida Indian Nation is a partner in one of six bids to operate mobile or online sports betting in New York. The state is expected to award two licenses for online sports platforms needed to place online bets. Bidders hope licenses are at least issued in time for the February 2022 Super Bowl. President Joe Biden nominated a Umatilla's tribal citizen to lead the National Park Service. If confirmed, Chuck Sams would be the first Native American to hold the position of director. Sams is Cayuse and Walla Walla and a citizen of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. According to White House officials, he's also worked in state and tribal governments and a nonprofit natural resource and conservation management fields for more than 25 years. For National Native News, I'm Trip Krause.
A graphic novel illustrated by a University of Illinois professor aims to serve as a primer for young people to learn about the history of the Greenwood District in Tulsa, Oklahoma, often known as Black Wall Street, destroyed by a white mob in 1921. Lily Bolke has more.
It's called Across the Tracks, Remembering Greenwood, Black Wall Street, and the Tulsa Race Massacre by Alvern Ball of Joliet. Graphic design professor at U of I at Urbana-Champaign, Stacy Robinson illustrated the book. He says it's about the destruction, but also the rebuilding of the city and the survivors that to this day are still seeking justice.
The weight of this subject matter is balanced by very beautiful, very opulent colors, and there's joy in the book as well. American history did not happen in black and white. It did not happen in sepia tones. I wanted the audience to feel this black beauty, to feel the opulence of this town.
Survivors and descendants of the Tulsa race massacre are calling on the Justice Department to launch an investigation and help find the mass graves of hundreds of Black residents who were killed. In a recent letter, they've said they don't trust local and state officials to handle the remains with compassion or to meaningfully investigate the deaths. Robinson notes in Tulsa before 1921, it said that dollars circulated more than 20 times before leaving the Black community, which is a key component of wealth building. He says kids and teens should be aware of this history to help understand the racial wealth gap that exists today. The net worth of the average white family is 10 times more than the average Black family.
If you know Black Panther, there's the Nation of Wakanda, right? Well, Black people have had our Wakandas. We've had our Black liberated autonomous spaces. And when we have these spaces, they are destroyed because we are Black and affluent.
Robinson adds, while the Tulsa race massacre is not often taught in schools, more and more people are learning about it with its 100-year anniversary. He notes the HBO series Watchmen and Lovecraft Country, set in Tulsa, are also boosting awareness and hopes the graphic novel can serve as another entry point. This is Lily Bolke with Illinois News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators for transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 20th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Tripp Krause, and Mike Moen. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Sam Bowman. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become